Good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for getting out of bed so early to come and talk about the importance of considering disparities in breastfeeding. And thank you to my wonderful co-panelists. Their presentations have been incredibly stimulating. And I think you'll actually find a lot of similarities between mine and yours. And I'm 5 foot tall. So I have no relationships to disclose. I would, however, like you all to be aware that the study I'm presenting today is slated to be published in 2011 in an anthology called Beyond Health, Beyond Choice, Breastfeeding Constraints and Realities. The book is a representation of the rich discussion that has transpired in years of the Breastfeeding and Feminism Symposium, culminating in 2010 with the presentations that constitute the book. I hope you'll all attend this year's symposia, which is being jointly hosted with the Coalition for Improving Maternity Services on March 11th and 12th in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. How's that for no disclosures? So child sexual abuse, which I'll summarize for the sake of getting in 20 minutes as CSA, child sexual abuse of girls is a prolific problem in the United States. One in four girls in the United States report having been sexually abused before their 18th birthdays. And millions more endure this trauma and never disclose at all. Rates of childhood sexual abuse continue to rise throughout the nation and only attempt to quantify the violence that is so commonly inflicted upon girls in the United States. Social work, criminal justice, psychology, and the health sciences have slowly begun to recognize child sexual abuse as a problem of epidemic proportions in need of population-level action, with very few actually moving in that direction. You'll note from the slide that women are especially at risk of being victimized as children, and then again during pregnancy and early motherhood. This parallel is not lost on the survivor mothers you'll hear about today. I approach my work on child sexual abuse from a feminist orientation, where CSA is framed as an issue of gender and power inequality that arguably results from and is exacerbated by continued unequal power dynamics between men and women, adults and children, and as an experience that impacts women's lifelong sense of physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. Coming from this tradition of feminism, I designed a study that I hoped would empower women to break their silence, hoping to heal and learn in the telling of stories. I hope to incite a revolution in the way we treat survivor moms, using their voices as our motivation. Now, many have suggested that surviving child sexual abuse is likely to impact women's breastfeeding experiences later on in their lives. The evidence is largely considered anecdotal or hypothetical due to lacking methodology in collecting and presenting data. And it often suggests that breastfeeding may be impacted via re-experiencing trauma, avoidance patterns, dissociation, low rates of interdependency, decreases in self-efficacy, self-disdain, vulnerability to messaging from healthcare institutions and corporations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these are well documented to occur with higher frequency in survivors than non-survivors. However, there is an extreme lack of data to support these assertions, or the opposite. For public health professionals, our evidence is largely epidemiological, with a seemingly paradoxical finding that mothers who've survived child sexual abuse are nearly 2.6 times as likely to initiate breastfeeding as women who were not victimized in this way. So the goal of this presentation is to help guide us as public health professionals to prevent harm and promote wellness in the mother-child dyad, wherein the mother was victim to child sexual abuse. To this end, the intersection of child sexual abuse and breastfeeding will be analyzed in concert with the voices of survivor mothers. The quotations come from a qualitative exploratory study conducted in winter 2010. Women were recruited via informal social networks, invited to participate, asked for consent, and provided with the opportunity to write about their experiences with CSA and breastfeeding, especially how they see them as interrelating using a structural open-ended questionnaire. 92 women completed the questionnaires in a 20-day data collection period, with 73, including both demographics and narrative, therein being eligible for inclusion in my final analysis. The women who spoke out are truly exceptional, and still, they can only begin to capture the tremendous and diverse perceptions of survivor mothers. Using content thematic analysis and Atlas TI, I was able to note 10 themes that emerged from the individual and collective voices. The themes are divided in my presentation today such that half act as barriers and the other half act as facilitators to breastfeeding. But given the propensity of this group to turn challenge into triumph, I hope you'll consider the areas where their desire to overcome the barriers lead to the creation of facilitators. So I'd like to start with barriers and allow the mom's words really to speak for themselves, partly because I believe that they speak for themselves with such incredible profundity, partly because I've got 20 minutes, and partly because I'm going to save my implications for the end of our discussion today. But what we'll talk about as a quick review is significant difficulty in getting started, breastfeeding in public evoking shame response and inciting a familiar cycle of abuse, the fear of becoming perverted or raising a predator, becoming triggered during feedings, and dissociation during feedings. And those of you who do this work, this is probably the work that you've heard about the most, am I correct? All of the barriers and difficulties. And I do want to tell you, I want you to focus on hearing their words and imagining these women, and so you're going to see pictures. Don't freak out. If you want notes, you can get my slides. I know everyone likes to be able to see the words. In terms of difficulty starting, one mom said, "I think looming failure is what can create a resurgence of trauma. If we are marred as women, doing something truly feminine and intimate as breastfeeding can really rattle the old bad memories." Many women spoke about breastfeeding in public or planning to breastfeed in public and how that evoked a shame response and inciting a familiar cycle of abuse. I was told on a couple occasions to not publicly breastfeed, and my immediate reaction was shame. I was really angry, knew that I had been wronged, but had walked away in silence, quite similar to the abuse cycle I went through. Another survivor mother said, "I almost think that the abuse has helped me realize that I never have to be under somebody's control. I am deathly tired of pornographizing of women's breasts. Why should I cover my breasts? My son is eating. It is not my problem that some people have a problem with sexualizing everything. And that is directly from my abuse. Everything I did, every move I made was perverted in my dad's eyes. He felt that everything I did beckoned sexual attention. Breastfeeding is a way to feed my body, and I will not let somebody else sexualize this most innocent event." Several women also spoke about the fear of becoming perverted in the act of breastfeeding, or by breastfeeding their child and contributing to that intimacy that they may in fact be raising a predator. "I didn't realize breastfeeding activates chemical processes all over the body that you may have been repressing all of these years because of any rushing oxytocin and adrenaline that feels similar to panic and unwanted arousal that happens with molestation. I have heard and also felt like, if I feel this way, does it mean that I'm a predator? And the answer is no, it does not mean that. I remember feeling just aroused all over my body, like tingly everywhere, and my face got hot, and I felt really angry about it and angry with my baby because I was so uncomfortable and sad. I felt like such a weirdo and so gross." I think this is the most commonly piece that emerges from the literature and most commonly discussed among lactation consultants, where in fact, actually, when I presented this at Breastfeeding and Feminism last year, I asked all of the lactation consultants in the room who had told a woman, "Don't worry, you're going to become triggered in breastfeeding, and if that's the case, it's okay, you can just give up." Almost everybody in the room raised their hands. The physical sensations at night were very triggering, and I remember sometimes feeling very alone and scared. Those nights brought up some of the most intense feelings I've ever had about being sexually abused. I felt like the difficulty with breastfeeding did impact my ability to feel close to and bonded to my first son. I felt numb. With my second child, I felt more clear about what was happening, but I was still too ashamed to talk about it. After talking to a friend who also had some difficulty nursing at night, she was also sexually abused as a child. I decided that nighttime feeding was too triggering. We made the decision to supplement, and by 6 months, I had quit breastfeeding. Many women talk about dissociation during feedings, which is something that we know is an incredibly valuable coping mechanism for survivors of child sexual abuse that can lose its value as we go on to secondary and tertiary outcomes of the experience. I think, looking back from a very different altitude now, that I was unaware of most of the physical sensations of breastfeeding. It was something I endured for the sake of a healthy baby. I didn't like thinking of the physical sensations because I had had to numb myself so significantly for years and years. To wake up to those sensations would be to unlock the Pandora's box of body feelings. Like pregnancy, I approached it all very mechanically, keeping my reason and logic and problem-solving and planning mind in the forefront. It's the numbing that kept me from being present for breastfeeding with both children. The numbing is how I'd coped for years, and breastfeeding came closer than anything to breaking through it. But in the end, I kept that wall up and didn't register what my body was doing. But I still remember their eyes looking up at me, their fingers grabbing their toes as they nursed, a leg perched high in the air, and that milky smile forming around the nipple. There are a few images of them in my mind like that. Treasures. I'd like to move on to talk about the facilitators, but I hope you're all able to see how some of those barriers very quickly have turned to facilitators for these women. The facilitators are a strong intention to breastfeed, a determination and perseverance like no other, therapy specifically centering on their experience with child sexual abuse, a globalized sense of healing and empowerment resulting from breastfeeding, and reclamation, or turning negatives into positives. There was never any doubt in my mind that I wanted to breastfeed, despite how nervous I was that I would be able to be comfortable doing it. It was a choice very opposite of what I was taught and what my experiences would have dictated, but I was determined to do it. I knew that it was the right thing for my baby, and I was not going to let my abuser take that away from my child. Darn it. Therapy centering on the child sexual abuse experience was something that was referenced in about 60 of the 73 final narratives that were included. So this was something that was very, very critical in their experience. Before I breastfed, even with all the therapy that I had in grad school in psychology, I never heard a thing about the issue of child sexual abuse and breastfeeding. I feel that I never would have even tried breastfeeding after having been molested if I haven't had the privilege of having had so much therapy and support. Oops, sorry about that. A globalized sense of healing and empowerment. These women have some incredible stories, and I actually sat reviewing the data on Christmas Eve by the fire at my parents' house and just crying very Cornel West-like tears of inspiration with the things that they had to say about empowerment. I actually felt empowered by breastfeeding. I felt like I was taking back my breasts from all the perverts, that I was using them for what they were meant for, and that all those men were crazy, and I am fine. Breastfeeding my firstborn changed my life. It empowered me in a way that allowed me to start a business, write several books, raise my children the way I believed was right, even renegotiate the power structure of my marriage, which not only survived but became happier. I was also able to not overprotect my daughter. The few times someone made an inappropriate comment to her, she told me about it, and she interpreted it as the guy's problem. And finally, reclamation through breastfeeding. I think having been abused made me more committed to breastfeeding. Breastfeeding was me taking my body back. It was something only I controlled. It was sacred, an expression of the fact that I am not damaged, that I can love and nurture and give life, that my body can bring me and my child something besides pain. It makes me feel valuable, worthwhile, deserving, It has helped me to love and bless myself. It helped me to believe that I could succeed at something worthwhile. It made me love my breasts that before I had hated because my abuser watched them as they grew in and commented on them constantly. He owned them, and even other men owned them, until I gave them to my child. And now they belong to me. The peace and quiet contentment that I feel while nursing my child is a gift of healing and joy. I think I cherish that peaceful comfort that gives both my child and I more, because my child had had none of that peace and safety. Having been raised in so much pain all the time, it makes the joy I feel so much more precious. It is the only perfectly safe relationship. I can give my body to my child, and I will never be betrayed by that. And I know that it is right. I'm not doing something shameful. It is, in a way, the first time and way that I feel really clean, pure. I felt like an expression of the goddess herself, blessed, worthy, whereas before I had always felt like a worthless, dirty slut. My milk washed me clean. These stories demonstrate how child sexual abuse among survivor moms, they have this increased potential for vulnerability, but also resilience and empowerment over the non-abused population of mothers. Supported abuse recovery presents a unique opportunity for reconnection, redefinition, and normalizing of the embodied experience. Therefore, it is essential that survivor mothers not be pathologized, but rather appreciated in the complexity with which they present and supported as public health professionals are uniquely capable of doing at various time points and across the different levels of the social ecology. In the United States, child sexual abuse is treated on an individual level when it needs to be treated as an epidemic. Health professionals offer treatment. The legal system works to identify, arrest, incarcerate, and sometimes treat child sexual abusers. Social workers work with families to recover post-victimization and prevent re-victimization. Feminists make bold calls for gender equality to decrease the likelihood of child sexual abuse. I'd like to suggest that our role lies in filling the gap between enacting secondary and tertiary prevention strategies with affected individuals and working for broad social change. The stories of the survivor mothers in this study suggest that there's a critical association between child sexual abuse and breastfeeding. Public health professionals have a role to play, a key role to play, in conducting further research on this association in order to inform programs, health service delivery, and public policy. Specifically, some pressing research gaps include: what causes CSA survivors to initiate breastfeeding at more than twice the rate of women who did not experience CSA? Is there any validity to the often referenced hypothesis that survivor mothers cease breastfeeding prematurely? And if so, what are the predictors and mediating variables of premature breastfeeding cessation? I do want to note that I consider premature breastfeeding cessation not just according to our CDC and AAP recommendations, but rather what women intend to do and hope to do. What kinds of preconceptional, prenatal, and postpartum supports are beneficial in supporting the survivor mother to breastfeed optimally and to maintain her own health? What are the predictors and mediating variables associated with breastfeeding leading to healing and reclamation? And what is the risk of survivor mothers becoming sexually abusive? And what are the predictors and mediators? Personally, I don't think it's much, but these moms are scared, and we need to be able to help answer their questions. Beyond the science and the research, public health professionals can also enable happier, healthier breastfeeding among survivor mothers by supporting primary prevention of CSA in the first place. We need to offer our public health expertise to refine existing surveillance systems to better characterize the epidemic of child sexual abuse, both reported and unreported, substantiated and unsubstantiated. Last night I had the privilege of meeting a colleague who told me, well, that's not really an issue, is it? It's like less than 1% of the US population who's sexually abused as a child. He didn't believe my statistics. Offer undergraduate and graduate level coursework for public health students on child sexual abuse. At a minimum, include child sexual abuse in courses on more general child abuse and neglect. We talk a lot about physical abuse and neglect. How many of you have heard about child sexual abuse in the Department of Public Health? Advocate for additional research and program funding to be spent on public health approaches to child sexual abuse. There's one in this country, in the state of Vermont. Develop and evaluate social marketing strategies to prevent child sexual abuse and promote optimal breastfeeding among survivors. We know they have the intention. Let's help them get there. We can create didactic curricula and clinical guidelines for identifying and responding to CSA across the lifespan, with emphasis on our public health infrastructure and being careful to avoid pathologizing the survivors. And we can partner with the professionals who are already active in preventing and responding to CSA and seek out ways that we can be helpful to them. In closing, I just want to say that there is incredible potential of breastfeeding to bring about healing, empowerment, and reclamation of the body and self among survivor mothers. Maternal and child health can be broken down to the cycle of life. To support happy, healthy mother-baby dyads, we have to think back to protecting those mothers when they are just little girls. Public health professionals are uniquely situated to conduct this research and translate findings into population-level action. As these brave survivor mothers have told us, this is not the time for silence. There's work to be done. And I do have references here that you can see. I can take questions. Absolutely. So the question is, Melissa was noting, as I did in the beginning, how exceptional so many of these mothers are, and they are incredibly articulate. The question is, do mothers with less education feel the same way? And my response is, I don't know, go find out. This is the first study that's being published on breastfeeding and child sexual abuse with actual research having been conducted. I will tell you that 65 of the final 73 participants had completed undergraduate education, and about 40 of those had actually gone on for master's degrees, so they are truly exceptional. And I will say I tried to sample to be able to get more diverse experience, and it's not who responded. There is some research in child sexual abuse that suggests those with higher education have also had greater amounts of therapy and are therefore more willing to talk. So what we need to do is tell women, we don't care if you don't know how to structure it, you know, in a 5-paragraph essay. We want to hear your story anyway. It's a good question. Yeah.
This is a follow-up to that question, which is, was it only a written option?
It was. And Joan asked me, so the question is, thanks, Joan. She's really good at reminding us to repeat the questions. The question is, was it only a written option? And yes, it was, partly because I really wanted to be able to talk about this. It fit in well with breastfeeding and feminism in March. And I thought, there is no way I'm going to be able to do this in person with interviews. I also felt that the power of the pen among these women was important. And I was very surprised. At the end, it was completely anonymous. And at the end of the survey, I said, is there anything else you'd like me to know? And about 2/3 of them gave me their name, phone number, and email address and said, when you get to doing in-person interviews or focus groups or you just want to talk, could you call me? Yeah?
How does culture impact responses?
Variation by culture? So the question is, how does culture impact responses? It's also something we don't know an incredible amount. I will say that child sexual abuse is suggested to have significantly higher rates in the United States than many other parts of the world. We are not particularly good at protecting our children. In terms of variation in response to breastfeeding from CSA survivors, I don't know. I think our therapeutic model and our self-help model really emphasizes learning from negative experiences and becoming empowered from those. So I would imagine that that's probably fairly unique to our system of recovery. Paige?
About, you know, this framework for talking about breastfeeding, and we typically tend to ignore
And I'm wondering if we look at this issue from the standpoint, say, of these women, what would be perhaps the challenges or the opportunities of opening up conversation around this more diverse experience that women have breastfeeding in a sensory way?
I'm always hesitant to hypothesize without having directly asked many people and seen many studies. My best guess, based on my exposure with this population, is that it would be a mixed bag, where some people have really become very comfortable with the idea of embracing their sexuality and have worked very hard to actually find their sexuality as an empowering, reclaiming space. And for them, that would be really helpful. For others, the idea that breastfeeding is in any way sexual may be incredibly difficult with that predatorial, perverse fear. I think we would really have to do a lot of careful work on how that's framed. It's a good point, though. One more question? Cheryl?
Hey.
There has been, so the question is that many of the experiences that I described today may also be very similar to women's experiences with birth, and Cheryl knows that that's my passion, women's experiences with childbirth, and specifically whether there has been any research on this, and I will say that yes, there is some, and actually there's a great book out by Penny Simpkin called When Survivors Give Birth, where she actually did some interviewing. I would say that there is a real dearth of methodologically sound research on women's experiences of birthing, breastfeeding, and mothering in general after the experience of surviving child sexual abuse. Kathleen Kendall Tackett is also a big name in birthing and breastfeeding with CSA. Should we open it up to everyone?
Yeah. We have a few more minutes. If you have questions for any of the panelists, we could take those now. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
I have one. It was teenagers and social low-income women first online. Did you actually ask them about contraceptive use and how usually this is a target that we try to control family planning? And with exclusive breastfeeding, we're talking more about that infertility period, really discussing that with more people so that they understand this time of infertility. But I was curious, was that one of the questions also? Was it given at the hospital or soon after? Was that an effect?
The question was about contraception, and was that asked as part of the study with the adolescents? And I'll turn that over to Miranda.
Can I just talk from here?
No.
Okay. yes, contraception is a question. That's a whole other paper, sort of, that we asked about intention for contraceptive use, and then we actually asked, how are you contracepting at 6 months? For this particular paper, we didn't look at the interaction with breastfeeding, but we will, because I think that's a really important point that you bring up. The questions are there. They're in the data set. We asked a lot of questions. The Parenting for the First Time study is not just about breastfeeding. It's a lot of parenting behavior questions over the first 3 years of the baby's life. So there's a lot that we can look at, and I thank you for reminding us to look at that association.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. The question is about the lack of relationship between sleep deprivation and expected social support in the study with adolescents.
Dr. Volpe, did you want to? I know I'm supposed to be in front of the microphone, but her area is sleep. Did you want to take a stab, or?
Sure.
I can try.
Why don't you come up here?
Yeah. Sorry.
So we get you on the record.
I think the reason that the social support variables and the expected sleep deprivation don't match perfectly is because for many of the mothers, their social support, like Miranda said earlier, can take many forms, just having transportation, having help with buying groceries, having housing, and those kinds of things. But for most women, regardless of what level of social support that they're receiving, they're alone taking care of their infants at night. No matter, you know, whether they're married or not, they're still kind of usually the primary caregivers for their infants during the night. So whatever sleep deprivation occurs is going to happen for them personally. So they're not having social support doesn't buffer you from the high cost of taking care of an infant at night. And I think that was particularly revealing in that the low education adult mothers had the lowest perceived forms of social support and a high anticipation of sleep deprivation, whereas the adolescent mothers who also were perceiving a lot of sleep deprivation, they do have higher forms of social support because they're usually co-residing with an adult female relative still. And in a lot of cases for the adolescents, their mom actually does provide some kind of child care for their infants during the night. So they may actually have a little bit more of a buffer against sleep deprivation than the low education adult mothers do. So there are two interesting things, but social support may not actually protect mothers from the cost of taking care of infants at night. Did you want to add anything?
Thank you, and thank you all for coming to hear our wonderful speakers.